Move to case number three, please. Koski versus Nandex International Corp.
It pleases the court. This is an appeal from a summary judgment dismissing my employee client's age discrimination claim against his former employer, Spincraft. Mr. Koski, the employee, was fired at age 56 after 28 years of employment with the company. Below, the defendant did not contest that the plaintiff had established his prima facie case presented under the familiar McDonnell-Douglas formula, nor do we contest that the firing would be justified if the proper reasons were not pretextual. Therefore, the issue today is whether there was enough evidence of pretext to permit this case to go to the jury. There was abundant evidence of pretext, as laid out in our submissions to the court, that Spincraft's reasons are not worthy of belief. The district court found otherwise because, although paying lip service to the traditional standards for summary judgments, the court did, I'm afraid, make credibility determinations, particularly with respect to the man who fired Mr. Koski, that was a Mr. Schmitz, in the face of very highly questionable circumstances. The court also drew many inferences against the plaintiff and for the defendant, and ignored a lot of evidence that supported the plaintiff's claim of pretext.
Mr. One of my problems with your argument is that although, you know, I can see at the edges some disputed issues of fact, I'm not sure they matter. So, for example, you say that Spincraft changed its reasons for the termination, but it seems to me there's a theme that runs through everything they said, and indeed that Mr. Koski, as I recall, even admitted that he received oral criticism, regardless of where the performance review may or may not have been filed for some period of time. And secondly, this incident that occurred in Indianapolis, there are some disputes at the edges about how much Mr. Koski said, but certainly his remarks about Mr. Schmitz and his management were not flattering ones, even under your account of the facts. And Mr. Schmitz indicated that he felt he needed a person in this estimator position who he could trust implicitly, which sounds to me like a non-discriminatory, non-age-based reason for terminating him.
The problem with that, if I'm not interrupting,
no,
Your Honor,
please.
The problem with that approach is that it is true that in his summary judgment affidavit, Schmitz makes the prime problem these alleged insubordinate comments down in Indiana. This is the thing that really was the straw that broke the camel's back in his mind and triggered the termination. But the first time that complaint shows up in the entire history of the employment is in the summary judgment affidavit. There is nothing about that in the firing letter. There is nothing about that in this rather lengthy after-the-fact so-called review that Mr. Schmitz did. There is nothing in the personnel file to substantiate that as a reason for the termination. Now, in summary judgment, it becomes the primary reason. And that is why it is suspect.
Even though you admit that the incident happened and that, according to you, Mr. Koski just said something along the lines of it was difficult to work with the Schmitz management team.
We don't admit that happened by any means. There was an after hours, late night, in a bar discussion among employees, but that is presented now as a statement or a threat by Koski that he would, my client, that he would just not do his work.
I'm assuming that's not true at all.
It isn't
you
true.
Say it isn't true. And so my assumption is that nothing like that happened. But there was, anyway, I don't want to dwell too much on this incident. What about this long history of criticism of his performance?
Well, again, Your Honor, what has happened here is that the defendant went through all the old personnel records and they cherry-picked every single what was intended at the time as a constructive criticism, and presented that bowl of cherries to the court as a fair and accurate portrayal of this man's employment history and as a justification for the firing. But that's precisely the problem. For example, the district court starts out by referring to some critical comments made by a man by the name of Buck way back in 91. But the Buck report, the bottom line of the Buck report, quoting, he's doing fine overall and he's a valuable employee. The next thing the court relies on is a supposed report by Buck that was done in 1993, which is extremely questionable. It wasn't in the man's personnel file. It wasn't signed. It was never given to Kotsky. Kotsky never even had a review from Buck in that year. And this document, again, first shows up in the summary judgment papers with Schmidt claiming in his deposition, well, I found this in Buck's office a year after Buck left the company.
No, I understand that point of yours, but I thought Mr. Kotsky admitted in his deposition that in 1993 Mr. Buck verbally conveyed these things, whether they ever got written down or not being another issue.
Well, first of all...
Is that your recollection of the deposition?
I do believe, Your Honor, that in the deposition, Mr. Buck conceded that there had been constructive criticisms by not only Buck but others.
Mr.
Kotsky. But the problem is that those things, as I said, are cherry-picked out, put in a nice bowl, and presented to the court, and the court bought it. And I don't think that's right on a summary judgment. I think you have to look at the evidence as a whole, as this court has repeatedly said, and you cannot pick out little negative, I hate to use the word nitpick, but it almost amounts to that, and ignore all the positive things that are said. And of course, the most atrocious example of that of all, in my estimation, is the reliance the district court placed on this document that was dated a week after the firing, and which purports to be a review that occurred after this Indiana business that Your Honor referred to. Isn't it interesting that even though that document, according to the district court, was in preparation at the very time and subsequent to the Indiana matter, it's never mentioned. Yet Schmidt claims that he did this after the firing because he just wanted to document the reasons why he was letting the man go.
What in your view is your best evidence that the real reason is age?
That's just the question I was thinking.
My best evidence at this, I would say it's a combination of two things. Number one, it is documented statements by higher ups in the company that exhibit a prejudice against older employees, combined with the fact that you have
involved in this decision.
I'm sorry.
Are any of those people involved in this decision?
No, except that the person who did make the decision was present during these things, and I think was part of and certainly privy to what the culture within the company was. But that in combination with the fact that we have, I think, abundant evidence of pretext through missing documents, through suspicious documents of suspicious provenance, and that is all we really need at the summary judgment stage, if I correctly interpret the court.
Sound like you have any evidence whatsoever that age is the real reason.
Well, Your Honor,
who actually made the decision were motivated by age, and that's the bottom line question here.
Well, the bottom line at the summary judgment level is: did the employer really believe, or what were his reasons for the firing, which would otherwise be legitimate? Are they worthy of belief under the entire record? And if they are not, under the St. Mary's Honors case and many other Supreme Court cases, that is enough. You do not have to have, at the summary judgment level, a specific proof that age was a motivating factor, because that can be inferred from the fact that the given reasons are phony. That is what I understand to be the law, and it was not applied in this case, Your Honor.
Do you realize you've only got one more minute for rebuttal?
I would like to save that if I may, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, this is a case about an employee with performance issues that were documented by four different supervisors over a period of more than a decade. These supervisors consistently identified problems with Mr. Koski's communication skills and with his ability to work with other employees at the company. Mr. Koski admits that these assessments of his lack of communication skills are accurate. For example, at his deposition, he testified, quote, "It was difficult for me to be in groups and discuss things. I get very nervous. It's a hardwired trait of an introvert." He also said, "I'm quiet. Sometimes people think because you're quiet, you're mad or you're moody or whatever, I don't go out of my way to talk to people." Koski also admits that 2 months before his termination, he made statements to coworkers to the effect that he wanted Mr. Schmidt, the decision maker in this case, to be gone from the company. And despite these admissions of the reasons for his termination, Koski argues that there was some basis which required a trial in this case, and that simply isn't true.
Are there disputed issues of fact as to whether that sentiment, let's put it this way, whether other employees reported to Mr. Schmidt that was Mr. Koski's sentiment? I'm phrasing it that way because I don't want to get into a debate about what Mr. Koski really said in Indianapolis.
Exactly.
But people report to Mr. Schmidt that was what was said.
That's correct, Judge. My understanding is that there is no dispute about what was reported to Mr. Schmidt. There may be some dispute about what was actually said during this conversation in Indianapolis, but to my knowledge, there's no dispute about what was actually reported to Mr. Schmidt, and that's the real issue here, is what his knowledge was, what his understanding was of what was said. Whether what was reported to him was indeed what was said is really irrelevant here.
Counsel, what's interesting is, why did the employer wait 7 years to discharge him?
Well, I think this was...
his performance was that bad.
This was a progression, I think. At one point, he was actually in a management position. He was demoted from that position to the estimator position, and he went through a number of positions over the years. And while these issues were not sufficient, I don't think at the time he was in the management position to warrant his termination, it eventually got to the point when, combined with his disparagement of Mr. Schmidt, that Mr. Schmidt just decided, "I can't have this anymore."
Does your firm have a history of doing that, the firm that you represent? Of projecting this out for 4, 5, and 6 years to give somebody an opportunity?
Well, I can't say that our firm was involved in this decision throughout that period of time. I think that was what was done here because there was some hope that Mr. Koski could function in other positions because there were things that he did well. It just turned out in the end that the issues related to his communication and ultimately his negativity and disparagement of the management at the company overcame those, and it got to the point right. where they decided they had to terminate him.
Right.
And as counsel for the plaintiff correctly pointed out, the issue here really comes down to pretext. And as the court knows, once the employer offers a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for a discharge, the burden shifts to the plaintiff to produce some evidence to show that those reasons were false. And on appeal, Mr. Koski essentially advances four arguments. He says that, first of all, some of these review documents he claims were spurious because he didn't see them in his personnel file at some particular point in time. He argues that opinions and speculation of some of his coworkers supports his case. And he also identifies these alleged age-related comments by people who had no involvement in his termination whatsoever. And finally, he claims that Spincraft's reasons for his termination keep changing. And if you look at those and look at the evidence that, or lack of evidence to support each of those arguments, it's clear that none of them warrant a reversal of the district court's decision in this case. With respect to two performance review documents, the January 93 document and the April 98 document, Caskey argues those were spurious because they weren't in his personnel file, he says, in August of 98. First, Spincraft provided an explanation as to why those were not in his personnel file. It so happened that they were in another file at that time. And second, more importantly, Mr. Caskey admits that those documents accurately reflect performance review discussions that Spincraft supervisors had with him. So any disputes about where they were at what point in time really are relevant because he concedes they accurately reflect discussions that were had with him.
Could I turn just for a second, though, to the comments? Because weren't some of them made by people superior to Mr. Schmitz in the chain of authority?
The comments that Mr.
I'm thinking of the Womelsdorf comments.
Yes, I think that's correct, although with respect to King and Womelsdorf were the two were identified as the individuals making the comments. I believe at the time that Mr. Caskey was terminated, Mr. King was no longer the CEO of the company.
But if the CEO of the company and a division president are communicating this age bias, then why would it surprise us that a lower person down the totem pole like Mr. Schmitz implements it? It's not like some coworker is wandering around saying inappropriate things based on age.
Well, there are two reasons. First of all, the comments that were identified are isolated comments that occurred more than half a decade before Mr. Caskey's termination. And secondly, there was no evidence whatsoever that Mr. King or Mr. Womelsdorf had any involvement in Mr. Caskey's termination. There's no evidence that they were consulted. There's no evidence that they had any knowledge whatsoever of the fact that he was terminated. And this court has repeatedly said that stray comments like those are not sufficient to sustain an employee's burden on a summary judgment motion. One of the other items that Mr. Caskey advances as a basis that precludes summary judgment, according to him, is the speculation and opinions of some of his coworkers regarding his job performance and treatment of other employees at the company. And neither of those provides a sufficient basis for rejecting the district court's decision here. First of all, everything that he's offered is simply speculation and opinions, not based on fact. He didn't submit any facts to show that there were older employees who were discriminated against on the basis of their age. He offered nothing other than opinions and speculation on that issue. For example, he relies on testimony of Wayne Schwindel, a retired supervisor, who says that he was moved to, from first to second shift, and he thinks that move was somehow precipitated by his age. What Caskey neglects to mention is the fact that the guy who stayed on first shift was the same age as Mr. Schwindel, so age could not have been a factor in that decision. In short, he fails to offer any facts to support the opinions and speculation of a couple of his coworkers that there was some age discrimination that was taking place at the company. And he also offers some opinions of a couple of coworkers that he was performing his job functions adequately, and therefore there's some disputed issue of fact on that. And again, this court has repeatedly held that opinions of coworkers are not the relevant issue. The issue is what was the opinion of the decision maker, in this case, Mr. Schmitz. And there is nothing offered to dispute what Mr. Schmitz's beliefs are about Caskey's job performance. As you've asked about and I've discussed, those issues were well documented by a number of different supervisors over a period of many years. And finally, the argument that Spincraft's reasons for Mr. Caskey's termination keep changing is a false one. The suggestion that the issue of disparaging comments is something that suddenly appeared in Mr. Schmitz's summary judgment affidavit just is not true. That has been something that was written in not only the ERD proceedings, interrogatory responses, it's something that's been identified throughout as a problem with Mr. Caskey, Indeed, at his deposition, which took place several weeks before the summary judgment motion was filed, Mr. Schmitz went into detail about what was meant by disparaging comments. It's not something that suddenly appeared in the summary judgment motion itself. It was there throughout. In short, Mr. Kosky failed to present any evidence to create a genuine issue of material fact. Instead, what he relies on are opinions, speculation, and conjecture, and these are precisely the type of things that this court has held do not create a genuine issue of fact. Instead, they create a false issue, the demolition of which is the primary goal of summary judgment. Somewhat ironic that Mr. Kosky argues that Judge Reynolds precluded him from having his right to a jury trial. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find an individual more inclined to allow a person to have a jury trial than Judge Reynolds. In short, the district court properly determined that there were no genuine issues of material fact, and this court should affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, counsel.
Just a couple of brief remarks. First of all, I would like to supplement my response to Judge Easterbrook's question, what evidence do I have of age discrimination? I would remind the court that we established, and it is not disputed, that we set forth a prima facie case of age discrimination under the McDonnell-Douglas test. That's not disputed. The district court accepted that, and the whole case came down to an issue of pretext.
Any evidence of age discrimination?
Pardon, Your Honor?
It can be, and often is done, without any evidence of age discrimination.
That's right.
That's why I asked the question, whether you had any evidence of age discrimination.
I see. Perhaps I misunderstood the thrust of the court's question, but in any event, I do not believe that's an issue at this stage of the proceedings. We'd love to have it, but usually you don't in these cases. And it's while it's true, all this business about a so-called history of non-communicating, granted, Mr. Kosky is not an outgoing type of person. He's not a smiley face type. But the undisputed evidence on the record is that for 28 years he communicated perfectly adequately in order to do his job. And with respect to...
We got half a minute, counsel, is over.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just would want to mention one specific parallel example that happened in the case. Mr. Schmitz pulled this same exact thing on Mr. Lamont, who was Schmitz's superior, and he went over Lamont's head and accused Lamont of not supporting his manager and is quoting, purportedly quoting, "I will not support my manager and I will not do my job." Sounds very much like that Indianapolis thing. Lamont testified that that was false, and the only person who could have purveyed that was Schmitz. And this is not speculation or guesswork. It was based on his investigation, which he described in his deposition and set forth in the brief. This isn't the first time, and unless we get a trial, it may not be the last. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. We will proceed to case.